education of our children doesn't begin and end at academia. There is a spiritual responsibility on each parent and teacher to nurture and train a young soul spiritually. This is called Chinuch. Join Rabbi G every Monday at 2 p.m. as he explores education and Chinuch for parents and teachers. Torah isn't education, it's transformation.
One 101.9 FM Chai Chinuch Rabbi G. We are back as we do every Monday between 2 to 3, where we discuss education, we discuss chinuch, we discuss everything important in the world that we can learn from, grow from, achieve from. And today we are doing something a bit different because we're not going to specifically focus on new skills that we could learn or hear from the professors, the doctors, the educators in the world, but we're actually going to talk about the current times that we're living in a long-term historical perspective. I'm sure each of every one of you enjoyed their break and their holiday and their times, and I'm sure that every one of us had a emotional moment, which we'll figure out what that emotional moment was, but an emotional moment watching the last of the live hostages come home and thinking about the families and the hostages that are not come home yet, although they're not alive, yet they're still away, still not home, still not with us, still in captivity. And a very interesting moment, because I remember for years growing up, whenever we would talk about historical events, it was a beginning, there was an end, and there almost was an end, but there wasn't an end, and what's going on, and there's some children that are still not there. And just to understand a bit more about where we stand with our mixed emotions and with our reality, with the historical events from a Jewish perspective, etc., and to have a bit of a touch on that. So let's start our discussion. First, I'll introduce our guests, as we always do. So the first person I'm going to say welcome on the show and say thank you for joining is Professor Karen Milner. Professor Milner is the national chairperson of the Jewish Board of Deputies, as well as the vice president of the World Jewish Congress. Good afternoon, Professor Karen. Thank you so much for being with us today. Professor Milner, can you hear me? Okay, we're going to have to get back to you. Let's say good afternoon to our next guest, and then we'll get Karen right back. So our next guest on the show is Rabbi Avidan Friedman, who is an activist from Israel. Good afternoon, Rabbi Avidan. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Shalom, Rabbi.
Okay, nice to have you on the show. Just a word about you, for those of you who are not familiar with you yet, a bit about what you do.
I'm an activist and educator. I live in Efrat. I teach at the post-high school program at the Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. I run an organization called Yanshuf, which acts to put moral limits on Israel's arms sales to dictatorships, the places to which it sells arms that misuse them. And for the last 2 years, my main activism has really been around the Chatufim, around the hostages.
Right, including, if I remember correctly, a period of time where you were on a hunger strike, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, number of hunger strikes, actually.
Okay. Well, okay, we'll get back to that. So I think Professor Milner is with us. So again, Professor Milner is the national chairperson of the Jewish Board of Deputies, as well as the vice president of the World Jewish Congress. Good afternoon, Professor Milner. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Good afternoon. Lovely to be with you, and good afternoon to all your listeners.
Okay. So just a word about you. I know that everybody knows you, and I know that you are the chairperson of the board and in Vitz and in many other stuff, as I said, in the international vice president of the World Jewish Congress. But anything you would choose to introduce yourself with?
Sure, I think not, although not everyone knows what the Board of Deputies actually does. So just to clarify for everybody here, the Board of Deputies is the spokesperson for the South African Jewish community, and its core aim is to protect the civil rights of Jews in South Africa. That involves fighting anti-Semitism, engaging with government and NGOs and other players in the South African arena.
Okay, a very strong representative. Okay, let's just say hi to our third guest today on the show. We are here with Jacob Nukwask, who is the director of the Cape Town Holocaust and Genocide Center. Good afternoon, Jacob, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Okay, so what about what you do?
Well, I'm a director of the Cape Town Holocaust and Genocide Center. There are three Holocaust and Genocide Centers in South Africa, and we deal with both the Holocaust and the issues of genocide, mostly through looking at the 20th century acts of mass violence that occurred on South African soil, on African continent. Before that, I was a director of the Galicia Jewish Museum in Poland. That's before I came over to the sunny side of the world.
Okay, going into summer. Before we start this chat, I think we need to look at just a personal moment for a second from each of you. I'd love to hear. I'll start with you, Professor. The moment you hear that the hostages, all the live hostages, are out, what is that like?
I think it was a moment of extreme emotion. I think that, and I've said it a few times, I would have loved it to be a moment of pure joy. And for a second, obviously, because they were live hostages and they were people that we've been longing for, praying for so long, there was a moment of pure joy. But I have to say, for all of us, and I'm sure I don't only speak for myself, that moment that should have been a moment of pure joy, unfortunately, also had we had to recognize the sadness associated with all the death that has gone over these 2 years. And in particular, I think for all the joy that we have that these hostages are coming back, and the relief we have of the hostages who are coming back but are not alive, that gives us some relief. But it also is a moment also of tremendous sadness for the families who will not get their sons and daughters and fathers back alive. Yeah.
It is a very complex moment. Rabbi Avidan.
It was really unbelievable. It was, as Karen said, it was in some ways complicated, but also in so many ways, what I felt, and I find what many people are saying is, you know, we feel like we can breathe again. One of the hunger strikes that I started was a little over a year ago, before last Rosh Hashanah, and then the feeling was, these hostages have been in captivity for, then it was almost a year. How can they possibly survive? How can they possibly keep on going? How can they possibly survive a winter when all of their resources are depleted? And here people survived 2 years. It was just incredible to see the strength of the human spirit of these people who were returning. And the sense that our faith and all of our hopes and our prayers and our actions and our protests had led to them coming back. I feel, I'll put it this way, for 2 years, literally for 2 years, I haven't been able to answer the question, how are you doing, without feeling a kvetch in my heart and hemming and hawing about it. And for the first time, although there is the pain of the hostages who could have come back alive, hostages who still haven't come back, all of the soldiers who have been killed, so much pain, but there is a feeling that I can say, you know, I can answer the question, how are you doing? Baruch Hashem, doing good. Things are looking better.
If you were in South Africa, you would say, well, and you. It would be easier. And Jacob, where were you at that moment?
Well, I think, you know, there was something deeply moving in that moment, and in many ways that feeling of joy, of relief, of anticipation was universal, whether you're Jewish or not. There were a lot of people that felt that perhaps that's the beginning of the end of that dramatic conflict. I also absolutely agree with Karen and with Avidan. I also thought about those who are not waiting for their living family members coming back, and how difficult it must be for them. That was this very, very sad moment, very sad part of that otherwise
very important moment,
joyful moment.
Yeah. Okay. We need to take a first break just to hear from our advertisers and what they have on offer for our listeners. When we come back, I think we're going to dive into a bit of the tougher realities that we're dealing with today still, and before we go to historical events and the historical perspective, but just how do we actually find ourselves and bring everything together as the Jewish nation, as people within the reality of what's happening in the world today. So let's just take this break and we'll be right back continuing this topic. This Gam Wellness Clinic for Adults offers convenient and professional care to help you manage health risks, whether you're having your regular wellness checks such as blood pressure or cholesterol.
Torah isn't education, it's transformation. This is Chai Chinuch with Rabbi G.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai Chinuch, Rabbi G. We are back and we are discussing current events, especially in the light of the hostage return home, the live hostages returning home, and everything happening around the world in that regard, and in, you know, seeing it in historical times. And I want to ask a question. I'm looking specifically at two of our guests today. On the one hand, I see you, Professor Milner, and Rabbi Avidan Friedman. Professor Karen Milner, you are, and I'll say about both of you, there's no doubt, and I think everybody who knows you knows how much you fight for the Jewish people and for the country of Israel, how much care and love you have, an absolute investment in the Jewish people and Israel as a country. Practically, I think it would be fair to say that, Professor Milner, you're spending a lot of time and energy defending the reality and allowing Jewish life and making sure that people in the Jewish community in South Africa feel safe and feel comfortable and being able to feel safe around their identity and connection to Israel. And on the other side, Rabbi Avidan, you are also taking a strong role of putting in awareness. I don't know if criticism is the right word, but making sure that the ethics are kept and making sure that the high standards, and that includes sometimes potentially criticizing or questioning or challenging, which is almost the opposite side. How do these two work together, knowing that you're both in a position of care and love and concern and wanting to make things work together? Professor Milner, how do you see that?
I don't really see a contradiction in what you're saying. I think I also need to clarify, as I said before, the role of the board is to protect the interest, is to protect the civil rights of South African Jewry. It's actually not necessary. It's not our role to protect Israel. It's not our role to defend Israel. I know that people sometimes get this wrong, but in fact, we do still have an Israeli embassy sitting in Pretoria, even though there isn't a permanent ambassador there. So that's the key issue here is that, unfortunately, yep, anti-Zionism more often than not becomes anti-Semitism in the way that it's practiced, in the way that it's expressed. I think that very often Jews' full identities in South Africa, the vast majority of Jews in South Africa, have a connection with Israel. So obviously we want Jews to be able to express their full identities in our country as our constitution allows. And therefore, when I'm protecting Jews in South Africa, that often means engaging on issues around anti-Zionism. And I don't see correct that as necessarily, I don't comment on the Israeli government. That's not my role. There are plenty who can defend or not defend the Israeli government. That's really not the role that I take at all. The role that I take is I believe that Jews have the right to be Zionists in South Africa. Jews have the right to maintain their historical, familial, and religious ties to Israel. And if that, then that's absolutely guaranteed within our constitution, and remains absolutely critical to our role.
Yes, and I hear that 100%. Yet it does feel that one of the weapons of anti-Semitism against Jews in South Africa is by criticizing the behavior of Israel and Israel government, etc. And I'm making an assumption here that when that is used as a weapon to harm Jews in South Africa, that is an area that you need to react to. So
absolutely.
Okay, and that's where it comes in potentially, and because, you know, when people have good and constructive criticism coming from care and love, and I will hear from Rabbi in a moment, it can be used in a way that will make Jews in South Africa feel uncomfortable.
Are you asking me? So I think that there are really, I think that there are ways to criticize a government and that, and I don't think that the ways that one criticizes a government are inevitably or even necessarily anti-Semitic. And I mean, I often make the analogy of, for example, the South African government. There's a lot to criticize about the South African government as well. There are ways of criticizing the South African government that are actually extremely racist and are actually unacceptable. That doesn't mean that all criticism of the South African government is racism and unacceptable. And I think that as Jews, we should and can tell the difference between that. And I think that the scenario in Israel for people in Israel is very different from Jews in South Africa, where the reality is I'm not convinced about the ways in which the criticism of Israel that takes place in South Africa is not anti-Semitic. So I think of something like the government taking Israel, our South African government, the ANC government taking Israel to the ICJ, which took place on the, and I remind you of the date because it's important, the 29th of December, 2023. I also remind you of the fact that the South African government called what was happening in Israel a genocide on the 8th of October, 2023. I have a letter from the ANC stating that what was happening in Gaza was a genocide on the 8th of October, 2023, or the 9th of October, 2023, before, in fact, Israel had started their incursion into Gaza. So I think that they're very different things. What a population that sits as citizens of a country that vote for the government of that country have to say about that country is one thing. And what a population who feel a connection to that country and who are entitled to that connection to the country, as I said before, for a very large number of reasons, including religious, I think they are completely different issues. And I don't see that the criticism that comes from inside Israel is necessarily a problem for South African Jewry. I think that we can hold two ideas in our heads, at the same time, recognizing when the extreme vilification that we have seen from some quarters in South Africa is over the line, unacceptable, that is different from recognizing that people who live in a country, and certainly people who live in a democratic country, are entitled to say and criticize their government.
Their thoughts and be active for it. I think that, yeah, very, very clear, I think, how you put it. Rabbi Avidan, your thoughts about this? Is there a line sometimes that you say, well, I would want to comment, but I'm scared it's going to be used against the people and I'm going to be extra aware, or, you know, when things have to be fought for and stood up for, then you do it?
It's a good question. It's definitely something that is to a certain extent on my mind. It's also very, very hard to know. And on the one hand, I do think, you know, haters are going to hate. Anti-Semites are going to find what they want to find, and we do need to be, I need to be honest. In my love of Israel and in my support of Israel, the phrase "my country, right or wrong," continues to, when right to keep it right and when wrong to make it right. So I do feel that, and I do feel that ultimately, one of the most important things, both for Israel and for world Jewry, is to ensure that Israel is living up to its highest moral aspirations and what it can be and what it means to be. That's not to say that if we do that, everybody's going to love us. And it's not to say that the reason that anti-Semites don't like us is because we're behaving more badly than any other. Those two things are distinct from one another. But I think at the end of the day, it is important for there to be standing up and saying, this is what we believe in, this is what we should be happening. And yes, and it's also part of a vibrant democracy where there is a government that could be acting, but there might be masses of people that disagree with the way that the government is acting. And unfortunately, that has been the reality in Israel in the past 2 years and even in the past 3 years. You know, I will say my own, in terms of these feelings, my own feeling as an Israeli citizen is, even though I'm an immigrant and I'm an American citizen as well, I really want Israel to be taking care of its problems and to be fixing itself. I really don't want to see, I'm not thrilled to see other countries stepping in and fixing our problems for us. So first and foremost, I want to see Israel fixing its own problems. And I think that when we do that, that is what ultimately serves the Jewish people in the best way.
Okay, amazing. And seeing that line, I don't know why, it almost comes to mind in a biography that was written on Tommy Lapid, that before he went into politics, he was the head of the national media and, you know, TV, radio and everything there. And on his first day, when they asked him his opinion about how to present the news, he says, we're objective, but we're not neutral, because we do live here and we are the Jewish people, but we have to be objective, but we cannot be, we're not the judge. We're sitting on a certain side of the field, and we do believe and we do stand for the country. Jacob, I want to ask you from your side, as you know, being very involved in the historical events of the Holocaust and Genocide Center, and obviously looking at what was the buildup in the nations before these horrific things happened, where do you see the line between the, you know, the freedom of speech, the discussion, the opinions, and where it starts becoming deadly, potentially, that will become into a harm? From what you've seen in genocide cases or Holocaust compared to what's happening today?
Well, we've seen that, and that's terribly important always to remember that mass violence and the genocide as an example of the mass violence, it doesn't start from scratch. It doesn't come from nothing. As one of the Holocaust survivors said, Auschwitz did not fall from the sky. There was a road. There was a long process that is leading to the genocide, and it the humanization, the change of the vocabulary, is part of the of that process. And that's why we're also insisting on the power of language, the power of words. This is a terribly important step. That can lead to dramatic results. And yes, we've seen a lot of things since October 7 in the Holocaust/genocide scholar world. One of them is conflation, appropriation, relativization of the Holocaust vocabulary. We've seen number of situations in which people been throwing that word genocide, which should be which for decades would be like an atomic bomb, the A word, you know, the word that you would bring up only in a very, very dramatic moment. Suddenly, people been throwing that word at all the occasions, and that is a major problem. Obviously, again, there are a number of reasons why. In this particular, this conflation is so visible. There is this idea that state of Israel came to being as a result of the Holocaust, and that's something that can be discussed. I mean, again, from Eastern Europe, you witness the longing of the Jewish people for their for the Israel that pre-exists the destruction, but that been there for centuries. I mean, if you travel to Poland itself today, you'll find roughly 800 synagogues. This is only a small fragment of the world that once existed there, but 800 synagogues still stands. And if you go and look at them, every single one of them will have Aron HaKodesh on the eastern side. Every one of them. And the reason is very simple. This is the result. This is a symbolic manifestation of the longing of those people for Jerusalem, for Israel, and so this is. But that's not something that people today want to discuss. This hijacking of the Holocaust-related vocabulary is precisely being we see that as a attempt to undermine the Israel, precisely because for many people Israel has been created as a direct result of the Holocaust. So I think there is no it's not a coincidence that we see that weaponization of that vocabulary in particular.
At the same time,
and that's very, very dramatic.
At the same time, are we not also ignoring the fact that language has become very extreme in general? Talking from politicians who call their opponent fascist just because they have a different view, to our teenagers coming home and saying, I'm starving, I'm dead, I'm going to die now. And everything is extremely extreme, and extremely is the best, the worst. And at what point do we say, no, this is out of hand? Or at what point do we say, okay, that's the world we live in. Everything is like amazing, great, unbelievable. Like, you can't end off a review on something saying it was good. It has to be, it was really special and great, and it was really amazing, and it was really incredible. Is it not also happening in the negative?
Well, I think you're absolutely right.
So where would we put that line in?
Instant.
Okay. So, Professor, you also, you know, on the other side, you're in psychology, and in that report, where do you draw the line?
I think that the line is really, really very clear, actually, between hate speech and freedom of speech. Hate speech is dehumanizing, it impacts people's dignity, and it calls for violence. And I think if any one of those elements, I don't think that anyone's got a right to impugn someone else's dignity. And I don't think that that should fall under hate speech. And I think that you're right. I think maybe there has been a dilution of language. But I think even within that, impugning a person, a dignity, a human being's dignity, is a very precious thing.
And we need to respect
and
that.
And for me, that's where the line draw. That's for me where we can engage on lots of discussions. But as soon as you make somebody feel less inhuman, I think that that's where I would draw the line.
Okay. Rabbi Avidan, your take on this?
Certainly, I agree with what you said about, you know, the general state of discourse is very, very problematic. You know, as an educator, it's something I see in students in the classrooms, the types of discourse, and you know, so there are a number of different levels and dimensions that need to be addressed. Now, one is the level of law, where you say this is illegal, this is hate speech, this is inciting to violence. I absolutely agree with Karen. And then there's also a broader and a deeper question of education, of how do you educate people to speak respectfully to one another, to respect different.
I think that's a very important concept, 100%. We do need to take a short break for our advertiser and hear what they have on offer. Then when we come back, we'll go into, maybe the positive, the education and what we can and what we can't do. A short break and we will be right back.
Torah isn't education, it's transformation. This is Chai Chinuch with Rabbi G.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai Chinuch, Rabbi G. We are back and we're in a fascinating discussion regarding the reality of today, considering the hostage deal and considering where we're living and what's happening and where do we see ourselves as Jews and understanding the hectic and historical times we're living in. And right before the break, we spoke about the need for educating for a better future. And I'm going to start with you, Rabbi Avidan. I know you need to leave the show now. Just quickly, what would your objective be of, okay, where do we need to go from here? What do we need to invest in education for the next generation or for future times?
Well, that's a big question to answer on one foot. And I think there are probably significant differences between what's needed here in Israel and what's needed in the diaspora. So I certainly wouldn't deign to know what contemporary needs. I'm not familiar enough. I would say one very general thing that I find, which isn't Jewish per se, but just has to do with the world that we live in, and I think the solutions can draw on very Jewish values, is really the value of dialogue, the value of healthy debate, machloket, and that is practiced in a midrash, in a chavruta, in learning face to face. One of the things I feel, that we experience very, very, very strongly in Israel is, along with the outside threats, no less troubling and concerning has been our internal divisions and the polarization within the community, and the way that and social media has a big role in this, and algorithms have a big role in this, the way things are so polarized and people just aren't people to one another anymore. People become caricatures, and the ability to sit down face to face and discuss with someone things that you disagree with and able to discuss. I think educating our kids on how to speak to each other face to face, on how to listen, and how to develop empathy for people who think otherwise, and also to develop skills of critical thinking, to challenge things that they hear. I find that these are really, I think that these are some of the most important skills that we have now to work on.
So let's see how we take this practically, because Professor Milner, you are, in addition to your leadership in the Jewish community nationally and internationally, you also are practically, training the next generation of therapists, of leaders, etc., and you're holding a lot of the future in this country. How do you see it? What is the aim and direction we're taking?
So, I mean, I think practically, I think that there are a number of elements there, but I think that the challenges that we haven't had before and that are really contributing to this enormous lack or divisiveness globally, we've spoken about it briefly, but I think social media has played an enormous role in that. And I heard somebody say today on social media, which really struck me, he said, it seems to be bots on one side fighting with bots on the other side. And in fact, you don't even realize that there's not a human being necessarily that you're responding to on the other side, but the whole algorithm is designed to increase, your account gets monetized based on the amount of engagement you get, and the more divisive you are, the more engagement you get. And I really do think that is a genuine threat to everything that you've spoken about, which goes beyond the capacity of psychologists or really individuals to address. I think that we really need to be working much better with social media companies, because this is a threat, and I think it's going to get worse, not better, as artificial intelligence starts taking over more and more of these roles. So I'm sorry, I don't know if there's time. I didn't answer you about the psychologist, but to me,
Okay, so at what point do we accept that the internet is not the place where the public speaks, and it's not, and we cannot refer to it any longer as the voice of the people, because it's obviously not. It's the voice of the butts and the voice of the influence and whatever it is. Is there, or are we close to that point that we'll actually wake up and say, well, this is maybe an interesting platform, but it's not the voice of the people anymore?
So I think, and I mean, I'm going to hope maybe Jacob could even reply to some of this. I think if you look at some of the things that have been happening on social media, for example, things like the kind of Holocaust, the Holocaust denial that we're seeing now on social media, I'm hoping is not a representation of what most people consider and most people think. And I also do think that there has been quite a pushback and quite an attempt to address the kind of Holocaust denial and the mocking of the Holocaust and the way that the Holocaust is depicted amongst some accounts. Having said that, though, I mean, if we look in America at some of the things that are being said now by people who have massive, massive platforms, I think on the one hand, we can say it doesn't represent, I hope, it doesn't represent the majority of people. And I'm not sure if the answer is to engage more so that we make sure that there is a presence there that is telling the truth. And for me, a lot of that, though, has to lie within those who have the power to moderate those platforms. I believe very strongly, as strongly as I believe in freedom of speech, I believe very strongly that those platforms cannot become platforms for hate and must be moderated.
They need to be in a civil communication. Jacob, I have to ask you, and your personal opinion, even if there's no scientific proof or anything about this, do you think history would have been different if there was social media in 1930s?
Oh, wow. No, I don't think. I don't think the history would have been much different. Because I think it's a little bit of a vicious circle. And it's hard to say what's first, a hen or an egg. You know, whether social media are what they are because of us, or it is us who we are because of social media. I think social media, especially now in that very corrupted version, are unfortunately living off negative emotions, and that's precisely what Karen said. Because they were considered to be a voice of freedom, of a new world, a hope for a better, more equal a society, and at some point they were. I mean, we all remember the revolutions in Northern Africa that were possible because of the social media.
Right, I was going to say, but Arab Spring, etc., that was able because the government can't control people. So potentially there could have been another voice then.
But then, unfortunately, I think social media turned out to be what they designed to be, and many money-making tools. And they understood that the money are in short videos full of violence, hatred, action, because that's what touched the eye. And I think that that's very unfortunate that we're not teaching not only the youth, but also our generation, that what we see in social media is not a real representation of the world. That the social media are creating echo chambers in which they are feeding us with what we are seeing. And that's, again, not a representation of the real world. So on the ground, and that may be a little bit of a positive news, on the ground for our work with thousands of South African students, we see actually how little effect this entire 2 years have had on those students.
Really?
That they are still,
that's surprising.
In most cases, friendly, open, interested, smart young people who wants to live in a better place.
Amazing.
So I think that may be a positive news that is not so eye-catching to get filtered through Facebook and Instagram and all the other.
It almost sounds like the youth are taking it a bit less serious than we're taking it, to the point that it's not fully overtaking their ability to be interested in hearing other sides, etc. We do need to take our last break for the show, and when we come back, we'll start heading pretty much till the end of the show. A short break. We will be right back.
Torah isn't education; it's transformation. This is Chai Chinuch with Rabbi G.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai Chinuch, Rabbi G. We are back, and we're at the end of a very important discussion, a very important chat and show we had today. To end off the show, I want to ask two of our guests that are with us now, just the same question is, what do you wish and hope we would know or do different for a better future for our South African nation and community?
Without sounding trite, and I think it's important to say that I really do believe that South Africa's history has something to offer us in terms of what we can do and how we can hope for a better future. I grew up, I remember 1994 South Africa very well, and I remember quite a lot of the despair leading up to the 1994 elections when it seemed like South Africa was going to descend into a civil war. We were pretty close to it, actually. But what won out, really, were true South African values, which is that there was negotiation, there was reaching out. There was, in fact, arguably a mini civil war in KwaZulu-Natal, between the IFP and the ANC, and people reached out to each other across those battle lines, and they spoke to each other. And I think that at the most minor level, I think it starts maybe in the home. It starts about learning to speak and engage and treating and people connect. And seeing everybody as having dignity in the home. And from there, the South African spirit of Ubuntu is not a trite marketing statement. It really is the idea of we see each other as humans and we see past our differences to the humanity within the other.
Amazing. Never forget our Ubuntu here. It's extremely important and seen. Jacob, what do you wish and hope? We have about 30 seconds left.
It's going to be important as it comes from historian. The past is not the most important thing. It is the future. And I think we need to constantly remind ourselves that while it's important to know the past doesn't need to define who we are in the future. We can let go.
And we have to let go.
Because, again, the future is more important.
Amazing. And let's hope that we do remember always to focus on the future and see how we can better ourselves and be the people we want to be in the world we want to be in. Thank you so much to you. Thank you, Jacob, as the representative of the Cape Town Holocaust and Genocide Center. Thank you to Professor Miller, who is the chairperson of the board, Jewish Board of Deputies in South Africa, and the vice chairperson of the World Jewish, the Congress of Jewish, sorry, you see, I slipped my
World
mind.
Jewish Congress.
World Jewish Congress. You see, I'll remember it eventually. Sorry about that. And thank you to Rabbi for an activist in Israel. And we will be back next week with a new topic, a new thing. Thank you, Craig, for managing the show perfectly. Thank you, Senna, for putting these interviews together. And thank you to our listeners who are here week after week, Monday 2 to 3. See you next week with a new topic. Have a great, safe week.